The Church of God, the Eternal, presents Christ Suffered for Us, a message given by Mr. Robert Burke, for the morning service of the first high day of the Days of Unleavened Bread, April 23rd, 2024.
Good morning, brethren. We all spent a lot of time evaluating ourselves this Passover season so that we'd be able to properly partake of the Passover. And examining the self is not easy, because if we do it properly, it means we're going to discover and see things about ourselves that we don't like. And when we do that examination correctly, we're going to recognize our deficiencies and the aspects of ourselves that are carnal and not positive. They're not godly. That's just not a fun thing to do. That work is done, though. And so now we begin the Feast of Unleavened Bread, where we continue to focus on removing sin from our lives. And we remember that these 7 days are representative of our entire conversion process, beginning with baptism and ending with being born in the God family. And by eating unleavened bread each day, we should be focusing on our work of the self and this great mission that we're on, this mission to be added to the God family. So today I'm going to expand on the sufferings of Christ to help us do that. If we all have a better understanding of what he actually went through for us, it may give us a boost to use these days for more spiritual growth and character development. And not only now, but also throughout the year. What Christ did was important because it opened the way for salvation. And we know that he suffered and endured a lot, but the reality and difficulty might be hard for us to fully understand because the sections in the Bible that describe it don't have a lot of words to it. More details would make it easier for us to get a mental picture of what really took place. But the extent of what he voluntarily did for us out of love, it's just truly amazing, because the love that he and the Father have for us is a love we have trouble comprehending in full because our carnal minds aren't there yet. And we have insight, and as we mature more spiritually, we can understand it in a better capacity, but our minds are still limited because of our carnalness. If we think about it, though, the extent of sufferings physically and emotionally he was willing to endure for each of us is sobering. So today I'm going to provide information and thoughts to help us see the enormity of this task and just how great that sacrifice was. And if we can walk away with more appreciation for it, we may view the effort we put into our conversions better, maybe as a refinement of our priorities in life. Maybe keeping in mind that we know the time is getting shorter, we just don't have time to lose in our conversion work. I firmly believe that God is expecting more from us, and I want today's information to help us do more. And I will simply use the verses in the Bible about the events during his last 2 days and try to paint a realistic picture of the sheer difficulty of the entire ordeal. Partly physically, but also the emotional challenges he faced to remain sinless. The ability he had to dominate the natural responses of the carnal mind is truly amazing. The mental control he had, I think, is fascinating. And I want all of us to see how often he could have let his carnal mind react. How many times, whether it's great or whether it's small, how many times in this short time period could he have let the carnal mind react? And then as we think about the situations he was in, we need to think about how poorly we would have done in the same situation. We need to think about how badly we would have failed, because it would have been bad, because that perspective will help us see how great a thing it was that he actually accomplished. So I'm going to begin, I'll say, when the plan starts to really move into high gear, after Satan enters Judas, and when Judas plans to betray Christ. And this is when Mary anointed Christ's feet with a very expensive ointment. But Judas commented that, You know, the money shouldn't have been used for that. Instead, it should have been used for the poor. That was a much better purpose for that. And the question again, is he just being a good steward? Was his reaction based on loving and serving the brethren and showing what we should do in a situation similar to that? Well, no, right? Judas was not concerned about the poor because he was a thief. He wanted control of the money so he could profit from it. Let's turn to the book of John chapter 12 for the first verse today. John 12 and verse 6. John 12 verse 6. This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the bag and bare what was put therein. Well, right there, Judas lied directly to Jesus. And Judas's intent was all wrong. But after Christ corrected Judas regarding Mary and the anointment and saying that she was okay by doing what she was doing and it was a good thing, Satan entered Judas. You might ask why. Why did Satan enter? Not only because he was looking for an avenue, why was he able to enter Judas like that? And one reason is because that Judas was offended by Christ's response in some manner. Judas did not get what he wanted for his selfish purpose. He wanted to serve and execute a plan in a certain way. He wanted to help the ministry. He wanted to help Jesus Christ. He wanted to help the brethren in a certain way, and he couldn't. He couldn't selfishly profit the way he wanted to, and he was stopped. He was told he was wrong in the presence of others. By these things, he was offended. And this is the ultimate danger of offense, right? Our emotions can be strong and provide an avenue for Satan to accelerate the wrong thoughts or enhance our hurt feelings. And this can lead us to act in a way that is not godly, but carnally, and that can put us down a wrong path. So with betrayal now in Judas's heart, he then went to conspire with the Jews to catch Jesus. Now think of this in terms of the mental aspect. Christ knew he was being lied to, and Judas was the tool to start all of this plan in motion. So what would your thoughts be if a close friend was going to and actually did end up betraying you? Would you be angry? Would you think less of that person? I'm going to say these are the little times where Christ could have sinned based on an offended carnal mind. But he didn't. But these are the little times where we individually can and do fail all the time. And yes, this was a small instance, but it was an example of the constant opportunities Christ had to be offended carnally. And he rejected all of them. Because all it would take to fail would be one time. One time, small or great. Just one time to be offended and let the carnal mind react. Poof. And it's all over. No salvation for humanity. One simple time. That is how difficult it was. And then after that, they have the Passover. And that year, Passover is somewhere between 6 and 7 p.m. approximately. I'm going to give that as a time reference so we see things going through the evening and the next day. And at the Passover, that's where Jesus implemented the symbols of the bread and wine. And after that, they sang a hymn and went to the Mount of Olives. There, he gave the last instructions to the disciples and mentions that the Holy Spirit would be given later. And at that point, it's probably around 9 p.m. So we can say from this point forward, we can get a better point, the length of time that he was subjected to tests, because he was constantly, moment after moment after moment of abuse, one way or another, he needed to retain total mental control. And I want to impress on you, it was not easy. Yes, he had the full measure of the Holy Spirit. He was perfect, but he had a carnal mind, and he had a carnal mind that was reacting, and every single instance he overrode it and overpowered it. And I believe the more we see that and understand that, we could understand the enormity of the task that he undertook for us. And then in the end, we'll translate that of what we need to do for him. So then Christ goes to Gethsemane and prays for 3 hours. And so we'll say this time is approximately between about 9 and midnight. And all the disciples are with him. Then he takes Peter, James, and John and goes into the distance to pray. And he knows what's coming. And he's in agony because the mental and the spiritual battle Christ was experiencing, it was just purely intense. And we remember he survived 3 major temptations from Satan previously. And this was another intense, meaningful moment. And he had to pass this moment, which was not a small feat. We can't discount it. And that's part of the thing we need to understand from his experiences here. So we can't underestimate and discount what he went through. Because here, Christ had to resist the temptation to protect the self and submit to the Father's will. And we all know that. But that in itself is not easy to do because we fail at that all the time, every single day. So let's get a little better insight into that. Let's turn to the book of Luke, chapter 22, and we'll read verses 42 through 44. Luke 22, verses 42 through 44. Saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And there appeared unto him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. And his sweat was as it were great drops of blood falling down to the ground. So let's pause for a second there. Why would an angel need to be sent to strengthen him? What could possibly go wrong with Jesus Christ mentally at that moment? He was perfect. He had the full measure of the Holy Spirit. He had the Father backing him. He was God in the flesh. What could go wrong, right? Well, he was human, and he still had to fight and dominate those carnal feelings. So not only was he battling that, he was battling knowing what was about to unfold over the next number of hours. He could see what he had to endure. Sometimes when we see what's going to happen to us in the future, if it's painful or it's hurtful, the anticipation and the waiting makes it so much more difficult. But God told us he was in agony. So what does agony mean to you? And a basic definition means it's either extreme physical or mental pain or suffering. So Jesus Christ was in agony. He was in intense suffering emotionally. And God is telling us that. He is saying Jesus Christ was in agony. And that can be a very hard place to be. Because when we're in agony, isn't it easier for us to have wrong thoughts, especially if it's Satan agitating us? We're weaker when we're in a state of agony. So this was an intense moment. Jesus Christ passed the test, but didn't mean it was easy and he could just skate through it. He had to work for it. And what this is saying is, the battle was so intense, he was sweating blood. And this was the battle he willingly faced for us time and time again. So the picture in our minds needs to be of him in agony, of intense mental stress and duress, not just an earnest prayer, not just asking God the Father for help, but intensity to the point of sweating blood. So how hard do you think that challenge was? Well, think of your worst moment in life. Absolute worst moment. When you were in the most pain and torment mentally, did you sweat blood? No, I haven't. And I'm going to say, as bad as your experience was, it was not as intense as this. Christ was fighting and dominating that carnal mind. And yes, again, he did have the power of the Holy Spirit, and he used it perfectly, but he was working at it. And sweating blood is known to happen under extreme stress. It's a condition that's called hematidrosis. And severe stress, one way or the other, what it does, it can trigger the capillaries in the body. They can rupture. And the capillaries are the little tiny blood vessels located throughout the tissue, and they carry nutrients back and forth. But those capillaries are located sometimes near sweat glands. And in the case of a severe fear or stress, those little capillaries, the blood vessels around them can burst and cause the blood to exit and go into the sweat gland. And then blood will come out through the sweat. Another thing, though, what happens when this condition takes place is that the skin becomes more tender and fragile, and it can be more easily broken, which might mean that the beatings he began to take later could have caused more damage to him, at least initially, than if that didn't take place. So the skin possibly could have been prepped for even more damage. So he succeeds there, okay, and then the next part takes place. This is when Judas and the soldiers and the priests come into the garden, and it's dark and it's nighttime out, probably a little past midnight. And approaching are two groups of people, a band of soldiers and temple officers. We're going to turn back to John chapter 18 and read here. John 18 and verse 3. Judas then, having received a band of men and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, cometh thither with lanterns and torches and weapons. And in the Revised Standard Version, it reads this. So Judas procuring, right? So he procured because he negotiated and he bargained and he made a deal happen. He actively was involved, as we know. So Judas procuring a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. The soldiers were Roman soldiers that served at the Fort Antonio. And they were trained, no-nonsense soldiers. They were professionals, and they were hardened to fight. When it says a band of soldiers, that word band can refer to a military cohort in the Roman army. And a typical cohort was about 480 people. And again, they were all dressed in full military garb, swords, torches. They were ready for action. And then there were officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees. So think of them basically as the temple police. They were the ones that enforced the temple rules. They reported to the priests and the Pharisees, and they had daily interactions with the Roman guards, and they had arms too. So mentally, think of this. Think of seeing possibly over 400 armed soldiers coming to arrest you. Do you think that would be intimidating? So if it were today, think of over 400 Marines in full tactical gear coming to arrest you. Would you be intimidated? And what we need to think about is that the concepts of carnal minds, how they react, the larger a group coming against you, the more powerful it can be mentally. And it might be one thing if you see two, three, or four people, that can elicit some fear. What if it's a mob coming after you? That takes it to a whole another level, doesn't it? And in the movies, we always see it's, what, 10, 15, 20 people casually walking up to Christ? I mean, that's something, but it is not an impressive military force. The movie representation is nothing compared to the reality. So physically speaking, this must have been stressful to see. And then Judas betrays him with a kiss. And we're going to read that in Matthew 26, verses 48 through 50. Matthew 26, verses 48 through 50. Now he that betrayed him gave them a sign, saying, whomsoever I shall kiss, that same is he. Hold him fast, And forthwith he came to Jesus and said, "Hail, Master," and kissed him. And Jesus said unto him, "Friend, wherefore art thou come?" Then came they and laid hands on Jesus and took him. The word friend here is friend. It's a fellow. It's a comrade. So think about this. Christ still called him a friend. Still a loving attitude. How would you feel if Judas walked up to you and is about to betray you? Would you call him friend? Would you have love in your heart still for him? And the word kiss is the word phileo, which means having affection for. And it denotes a personal attachment, personal feeling. So it was not Judas just coming up and casually pointing, saying, "Oh, there he is." It's Judas walking up and appearing to have an expression of love, outward connection, total hypocrisy. Right? So think of the emotional, the mental aspect of Christ there, because Christ did not sin at all, and he did not have anger towards Judas, who was a total faker and a hypocrite and a liar and a thief and someone causing direct harm to Christ. Because at that kind of moment, it's really easy to have bad thoughts. And these are the beginning of the many, many small mental battles that Christ faced, and he won. And this is where I'm saying the perfection of his mind is amazing, because we know we wouldn't have responded that way. A flash of a wrong thought, of offense, whatever would have come into our minds, and we know it would have happened to us. So next, they seize Christ, and they bind him, and then they lead him away. And this is in back to John chapter 18, verse 12. Then the band and the captain and the officers of the Jews took Jesus and bound him. And then after that, as we read Mark, they all forsook him and they all fled. All the disciples left. They left their friend. They ran away. But I'm saying, don't think badly of them, because what would you have done in that situation? Think of the army that was coming after him. Possibly hundreds of armed soldiers, intimidating in sight and in sound. Isn't it a little bit easier to see why they left? And you think about it, what could they have done? Do you think they felt a little helpless? Of course they wanted to help, but what could they do in that situation? And what would you have done knowing you were powerless and knowing the fear in your heart? What would you have done? So here mentally, Christ was abandoned by his friends and he was alone to face something very challenging. The human toll and the emotions that go through mind can be various, but he still had no pity for himself. He didn't have any bad thoughts to the disciples. So what would you call somebody in mind if they abandoned you in your time of need, in your time of danger? What thoughts might pass through your mind? Would it still be love as it was with Christ? And then the temple guards take Christ. And at this point, the Roman soldiers probably veered off and stayed at Fort Antonia. The temple guards take Christ to Annas first. And Annas is the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was a high priest. But Annas was the former high priest. And we're going to continue in John chapter 18, verse 13. And led him away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. So Annas and Caiaphas were Sadducees. And the Sadducees did not believe in any of the scriptures beyond the Torah, right? The first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And in Jesus' time, the Sadducees controlled the two most important institutions of Jewish society, the temple, or Herod's temple, and the Sanhedrin. And many of the Sadducees were rich, and money and power influenced them. They liked power and money and reputation, just like carnal individuals do. And when people have that, they don't want to let it go. So the Sanhedrin was the governing body, both religious and legal issues for the Jews. The leader of the Sanhedrin was a high priest and given a lot of authority, and very often was a Sadducee. So remember this, the Sadducees entirely rejected the supernatural. They discarded the belief in angels and demons and heaven and hell and the resurrection. Right? To their way of thinking, you die, and that's it. That's the end. So here is Jesus talking about and confirming all of these things. All of these things are true. So in one way, why would the Sadducees hate Christ so much? Two reasons can apply. Number one, he threatened their false belief system. If Christ's teaching were right, then most of what they believed and lived was wrong, and that would mean they would have to change. Oh, change. I don't want to do that. But Jesus also threatened their close relationship with Rome and the political and social benefits that they had. Right? They're like the super wealthy or the royalty of today, and they didn't want to give up their wealth and their power and their reputation or their control, the things that feed their ego, the things that made them feel good. They didn't want to give that up. But also, while this is happening, keep in mind that Peter is following at a distance and he's watching. He wants to help, but what can he do? So Christ was taken to Annas, and we don't know what Annas's thoughts were, what he wanted to hear, but he did question Christ. And then Christ's response was, why do you question me? Go and ask those that have seen and have heard me. And in this response, an officer of Annas strikes Christ. Right, so that's the first abuse. And it was not a Roman, it was a Jew. And then for the guard to do this, think about what his feelings towards Christ would have been compared to that of his regard for the high priest. And we could probably sense it and feel it. So what do you think Jesus felt when he was hit by the guard for no legitimate reason, right? And knowing the extent of the disdain that they had for him? Is it easy to keep calm in that kind of situation? Is it easy to react mentally? It sure is easy. Okay, so then they take Jesus to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. And there's probably going to be between 70 and 100 people or more there. The Sanhedrin typically is composed in its fullness and its entirety of about 71 people. So if they were all there, temple officers, anyone else there, it's a large number. But we're going to go back to Mark chapter 14 and read verse 55. Mark 14 and 55. And the chief priests and all the council sought for witness against Jesus to put him to death and found none. And so they were looking for ways to convict him. They were willing to make up a lie. And they were calling in witnesses, but none of the stories matched. Didn't work. So mentally, he still had no hatred for the evil deeds that the priests were doing, the illegality of the trial, because it was all part of the Father's will. But how calm would you be in that situation? Would you have any bad thoughts in mind hearing people lie about you and try to falsely condemn you? Hard to do. And then finally, two false witnesses did come forward. Caiaphas asks Christ if he was Christ, and he was silent. What did this do? Matthew chapter 26 and verses 62 and 63. Matthew 26, verses 62 and 63. And the high priest arose and said unto him, Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witnesses against thee? But Jesus held his peace, and the high priest answered and said, I adjure you by the living God that thou shalt tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. So mentally, right there, who is he to command in God's name that he needs to answer? And again, no sin. Christ didn't respond initially with, well, who do you think you are? I'm going to tell you. He didn't have that kind of attitude. There was no contempt, and that was not easy. But he answers, and then what happens? Verses 65 and 66. Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now you have heard this blasphemy. What think you?" They answered and said, "He is guilty of death." Again, mentally, right there, a false death sentence was just put upon you. How about if a crowd, in a large crowd, they all say, "Condemn you, kill you, you are guilty of death," and they know it's fake? What do you think? How do you think it affects the mind? Not to panic, not to have self-pity, not to have remorse because you're in that situation? Christ didn't let that happen to him. So Caiaphas condemns him to death. And remember, the priests and the temple officers are there, so there could be 70, 100 plus people there. There are a lot of angry people there, is what we need to keep in mind. And now that he's condemned to death, they unload on him with fury. And they did three main things. And as you hear these things, how easy would it be to sin? In this situation, to have a wrong thought of some type towards those that are doing this to you. How easy. And for a carnal person, it would be easy. And these are the real instances when Christ was resisting his carnal mind and fighting for us and suffering for us. It is active work. This is godly character in action. This is God's mind in action. And it is based on his will and his power supported by the strength through the Holy Spirit. Yes, but he is using it and he is working it. And that is our lesson too. Sure, we have a down payment of the Holy Spirit. Yes, we have the opportunity to become more like God and think more like him, but we have to work at it. We have to be proactive with using God's mind and not be reactive. And that is one of the very important lessons that Christ is teaching us here. So they did three things. Number one, they spat in his face. And I don't know if it was just the temple officers, did any priests do it, but they spat on him. And with maybe 100 plus people there, how many actually did it? I don't know, but what if it was only 30 people, a small part of the group? What if 30 people came up to you and spit in your face, right? Slowly, one after the other, taking time to walk up to you, to express their hatred of you, to collect their spit, and intentionally to spit right in your face. And then after a while, your face is dripping with spit, and you can feel it oozing down your face. Think of that happening to Christ, the humiliation and the insult. What would you think? Because Christ had no sin, no anger, no self-pity, total mental control. What would you do there? Well, that was the first thing that they do. They spat in his face. And then number two, they began mocking him. So how did they mock him? And why would this elicit a carnal response, or could it, that needed to be controlled for no sin? Mocking is, you can say, it can be used to talk to somebody, treat somebody with ridicule or contempt. The important thing for us to think about is mocking can be used to imitate in fun or derision, right? To make fun of. So one way that they probably mocked him was to pretend to do the things and the miracles that Christ actually performed. Make fun of him. So what did Christ do? He healed injuries, healed blindness, he cast out demons, he raised individuals to life. So they probably mocked his healings and the restoration of sight to the blind and the casting out of demons. But most likely, what did they do? What's a possible scenario of what they did? They play acted. They acted on the floor, hamming it up, rolling around, recreating all of the scenes and laughing and making fun of Christ and making rude comments. Maybe they were stumbling around and walking into the walls because the healing that just took place didn't work. Maybe they were out acting all crazy because the casting out of a demon didn't work. Maybe somebody with an injury got up and was still injured. They still had an illness And they were complaining and whining about it because the promised healing didn't work. They acted it all out and said bad things to him and about him. And these were all the good things that Christ did. They were the godly things that he did. And they were making fun of him. And in verse 66, it says, and many other blasphemous things they said. So what else, right? What else? Mentally, whatever else they were doing, it was blasphemy. It was just not another level of contempt and ridicule. It wasn't that they just didn't believe in him. They were blaspheming him, their creator who loved them. So what would you do in that situation, mentally speaking? Not to get defensive, not to have self-pity, not to curse under your breath, right? And for Christ, that was true. He was not doing any of those things. He didn't have the urge to prove them right just this one time, right? Knowing the time he raised someone from the dead, knowing he healed someone's blindness, seeing that person's loving reaction and adoration to Christ for that, and here they are making fun of him and playing it up. Do you see any way in which you might sin in your response by seeing that? So again, how easy was it for Christ? How many mental battles? How strong was that mental fight and resistance? Okay, so number one, they spat on him. Number two, they mocked him. And then number three, they blindfolded him and they beat him. And they beat him in two ways. Number one, they hit his face with rods. And I'm going to say, who cares what kind of rod it was? It was a solid stick. And what does that do to your face? How many hit him? How many times? How hard? So what was his face beginning to look like in there? And what would you think if a group of people were hitting you in the face with a big stick? And you couldn't see, right? You had to wait in anticipation of the hit because you were blindfolded and you were going to be hit somewhere on the face. Maybe you heard someone coming up to you and maybe it was silent. Who knows? Think of the stress and the anxiety and the fear and the anger that could easily happen. But with Christ, that didn't happen. None of that happened. So they hit him in the face with rods, and they also hit him with their hands and their fists. They punched him, and they hit him with the palm of their hand, which is hard. Again, how many did this? How often? How hard? But when they did it, they were mocking him, right? Because they were saying, prophesy who hit you, right? Go on, who did it? You can't say, oh, that's because you're a faker. You are nobody. You're worthless. Prove it to us. Come on, prove it. You have power and you have insight, don't you? Or are you just a con artist? You say you're the Son of God. You really aren't. Come on. You could do this if you were. And doesn't that sound like Satan's temptations? And it is, because the source is the same. And these were the Jews doing this. It wasn't even at the Romans yet. So think of the emotional impact, right? The righteous, the pious and respected leaders and officers of Israel doing this. And yet no mental sin, no hatred for the evilness and hypocrisy that he saw. And this was the first real beating and emotional abuse by the Jews. So how bad did he look at this point? Bruised, bloodied? How much worse did his face look because of the skin being tender from sweating blood? I don't know. But also, Jesus is there for over an hour. So this was not a quick ordeal. Think of at least an hour of humiliation, of beatings, of false accusations, and of blasphemy, and by many people. Well, for us, when stressful and difficult things last for a long period of time, and we're in pain, we can wear down, can't we? We get tired. Oh, we get mentally weak. But Christ was maintaining strength. He was still maintaining love. Can you imagine that? Still maintaining love and concern with all of this. And he still knew the worst was yet to come. So just up to this point, can you appreciate a little bit more what he endured? How he had to fight, how often he had to fight, what it was like when we say he resisted his carnal mind perfectly. And not just to go through it, not just to grit his teeth, bear it, and muscle the resolve to go through it, but to do it with the right attitude and an attitude of love and compassion. Because he had that much faith and vision of the overall plan of salvation. And he was doing this for you, and he was doing this for me out of love. And remember, Peter was around for this. When Christ was being beaten and mocked, he witnessed it. And then Peter denies him three times. Let's turn to the book of Luke chapter 22, and we're going to read verses 55 through 62. Luke 22, verses 55 through 62. And when they enkindled a fire in the midst of the hall and were set down together, Peter sat down among them. But a certain maid beheld him as he sat by the fire and earnestly looked upon him and said, "This man was also with them." And he denied him, saying, "Woman, I know him not." And after a little while, another saw him and said, "Thou art also of them." And Peter said, "Man, I am not." And about the space of 1 hour, after another confidently affirmed, saying, "Of a truth, this fellow also was with him, for he is a Galilean." And Peter said, "Man, I know not what thou sayest." And immediately while he yet spake, the cock crew. And the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said unto him, "Before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice." And Peter went out and wept bitterly. So right now, this may be somewhere between 3:30 and 4:30 in the morning, somewhere around there. And Peter saw Christ being tortured and humiliated and devalued. So imagine the feeling he saw when Christ looked at him. He was beaten. He was bruised. After repeatedly being hit in the face with rods and punched on and spat on, what did Peter see at that moment? Not his Lord, as usual, but a battered and beaten person suffering in pain. I can see why Peter went out and bitterly wept after seeing that. And what did Christ think? Still had love and compassion in his heart. So can you see the strength of mind that he had just to do that? So afterwards, they take Christ to Pilate. As around daylight, we're going to say somewhere between 5:30 and 6 a.m. In verse 23 in the chapter, book of Luke, Luke 23, verse 1. And the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. All right, so they all go. Well, exactly right. But who's the all? Was it a big procession? How many went with them? Was there pomp and circumstance? Right? I mean, they already mocked him and beat him and said blasphemous things about him. So were they quiet? Did they just quietly walk through the street? Or did they continue to mock him and taunt him all along the way and make a public spectacle of him? I don't know. But if they did, can you see the mental challenge of that? So then once there, the priests begin to accuse Christ to Pilate. In verse 2, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation, forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." So Pilate questions Christ, but he didn't answer. So much so that Pilate marveled. And Pilate was no dummy. Historical sources describe him as kind of being cunning and deceitful and sometimes a ruthless person. His leadership was ruthless and brutal. So what must this have scene have been like, really, if Pilate marveled? And he did. The word marvel is thaumadzo, which means to admire, to have an admiration, to wonder. So it had to be something special for Pilate to react in this way. And right there should give us insight into the utterly miraculous way Christ endured this. This is saying, really, that there's something not normal about the situation, Christ's reaction, and the presence of everybody there. It was beyond how a typical person would respond. And it was so much so that Herod was impressed. And this is, again, this is only the beginning. But since Pilate found no fault with them, this made the Jews even angrier, and they yelled out the more. Mentally speaking, constant yelling, constant accusations. Does it have an impact? Of course it does on the mind. Would it wear you down? Would you snap after a while? Would you make a crass remark, just get these people to stop? So after that, Pilate sends them to Herod, where he hears, when he hears that Jesus was from Galilee. Verse 8, and when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad, for he was desirous to see of him for a long season, because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped he would have seen some miracles done by him. Right, so he wanted to see something, a miracle of some sort, kind of like treating like a circus animal. I command you to do something, and I want to see something fun, and I want some entertainment. Verse 9, Herod questioned with him many words, but he answered him nothing. What happened? In verse 10, and the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. So this word means fiercely. And God inspired this word to give us context to the magnitude of the event. They were aggressively attacking him verbally. So what did they say? Probably the same things that the others were saying. Some miracle worker you are. You have no power. You're a fraud. If you can work miracles, then why don't you do one now? Prove it. Come on, prove it to you. If you are who you say you are, you can easily do this. Go on. Go on. Temptations, just like Satan's accusations. And he was mirroring those tests. So he resisted Satan before with this tactic, and he's resisting Satan again, although just through the priests. Same accusations. It is still a big mental fight that he is under. So what do you think you would have done in this situation? After all that you've experienced up to this point, how strong would you maintain your mental composure? So then we get to verse 11. Herod and Herod's troops, they mock him and they ridiculed him. Verse 11, and Herod with his men of war set him at naught and mocked him, and arrayed him with a gorgeous robe, and sent him again into Pilate. The Revised Standard Version says, and Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him, then arrayed him in gorgeous apparel, and he sent him back to Pilate. And the contempt and mocking is something we need to think about, because it's easy to read over that and really not think much of it. But it is significant in our context of the mental battle that Christ was in. Christ had just endured the yelling and screaming of the priests and the elders, but now Herod and his bodyguards do the same thing, and they try to humiliate him. The robe that they put on him is meant for further humiliation. Right? They're playing along also. They're playing along with Christ's claim of being a king. It was another way to falsely accuse him, and it was another way to show public humiliation. So what do you think was going through Christ's mind at that point? He is a soon coming king. He is God in the flesh. He is all of the things that they're claiming he is not. Yet he's not full of any hate, no self-pity, nothing. He is mentally strong. So how much public humiliation, how many shouts of contempt, how many other things can you take before you react carnally? Just one time. Easy to do. So then Herod sends Jesus back to Pilate, and this is going to be around 8 o'clock. And we're going to read in Luke chapter 13, verses 23 through 34. Luke 13, verses 23 through 34. And Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and the rulers of the people and the people, said unto them, you have brought this man unto me as one that perverteth the people. And behold, I, having examined him before you, have found no fault in this man touching those things whereof you accuse him. No, nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done unto him. I will therefore chastise him and release him, for of necessity he must release one unto them at the feast. And they cried out all at once, saying, Away with this man, and release unto us Barabbas, who for a certain sedition made in the city and for murder was cast into prison. Pilate therefore, willing to release Jesus, spake again unto them, but they cried, saying, Crucify him, crucify him. And he said unto them the third time, Why, what evil has he done? I have found no cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. And they were instant with loud voices, requiring that he might be crucified. And the voices of them and of the chief priests prevailed, and Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required. So here you have the crowds of the Jews yelling at Pilate to release Barabbas, and a riot was about to start. They were that adamant with their desire. That's how loud they were. And Jesus is watching and hearing this. It's a frenzy of people. So again, mentally, a murderer is being released and not you, who is innocent. How would that make you feel? And also knowing that you could stop it at any moment. It was within your control. But Christ stays with the plan to fulfill the Father's will. And don't underestimate the carnal urge and the pull of the carnal mind in instances like this. And not just to go through it, but to go through it with a sinless mind. Not easy to do. So Pilate releases Barabbas, and Pilate's soldiers take Jesus, and they beat him, and they scourge him. And we know scourging was horrific, but often we don't realize how bad it really was. And it's important for us to get a little better understanding of what he did for us. Because if he sacrificed this much for us, can't we sacrifice for him by denying the self and loving the brethren? And as we review, keep this in mind. We're going to go to the book of Isaiah, chapter 52, verse 14. Isaiah 52 and verse 14. As many were astonished at thee, his visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. And I like the way the Living Bible translates it. So same verse in the Living Bible. Then shall they see my servant beaten and bloodied, so disfigured one would scarcely know it was a person standing there. So what was it standing there? A blob, a mess. Something that didn't resemble a person because that's how badly he was beaten. So let that sink in a minute. How badly was he beaten? And yet there was still more to come at that point. So our thoughts of having, you know, of seeing Christ and just having a lot of stripes and whip marks is all wrong. It's not total disfigurement, which is what happened. Yes, it says through his stripes we are healed, but what did those stripes really do? So think of this in a way. Think of a person working with clay. Right, take a ball of clay and fashion it in the form of a person. You have a little clay figure. Have that image in your mind. Now think of the same thing of someone doing that with a pound of ground beef. They fashion it up into a little human figure. And it's lumpy and it's red and there's white bits. That's going to be a little closer to the reality. The pulp of flesh and muscle and bone exposed, being unrecognizable. So I don't know how long it took to scourge or how many minutes. But when they scourged him, they used the tool called the flagellum, right? Short whip, braided leather thongs, different lengths. They had either iron balls or sharp pieces of sheep bone or so at the end. And then during a scourging, what happened? Somebody was stripped of the clothing, hands were tied to a post, and then they whipped him and they beat him from the shoulders down to the feet. And often it hit the face. But the flagella, the iron balls, the sharp pieces, they were designed to cut and to tear chunks of flesh right off the body. So typically speaking, what is recorded, what is known about scourging. It got so bad that many times people's spines would show. Often the lashes would hit the face, rip the eyes out. Often it would break ribs. Many times people's intestines would spill out because that much tissue and muscle was just ripped away from the body. Now, we know not all those things happened to Christ because he didn't have a bone broken, but this provides a little more insight into how brutal and deadly scourging was. For a second, let's turn to Psalms chapter 22 and verse 17. I'm seeing this in a whole new light. Psalms 22 and verse 17. I may tell all my bones, they look and stare upon me. So how many bones could Christ actually see because the skin and the muscle were just ripped away? Right? That's how bad the beating was. So the beating was bad enough for the description in Isaiah to be accurate. So Christ did not look like a human at that point. So pause for a moment and think on that. Because at that point, there's still more to go. Because after that, there's more mockery. After the scourging, Christ was taken to the common hall where the whole band of soldiers gathered, which could have been hundreds of them. They stripped him, put a scarlet robe on him, signifying his royalty, a crown of thorns on his head and a reed in his hand, and they bowed before him and they mocked him. We're going to read that in Matthew chapter 27, verses 27 through 29. Then the soldiers and the governor took Jesus into the common hall and gathered unto him the whole band of soldiers. And they stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe. And when they had plaited a crown of thorns, they put on his head and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" So the crown of thorns, don't know specifically, probably long thorns, maybe 1-inch long thorns, sharp, gouging into the scalp, which is sensitive skin anyway. And the scalp has a lot of blood vessels and a lot of nerve endings underneath the skin, which makes it very sensitive and an area for a lot of pain. So the thorns probably not only caused pain going in, they caused damage under the nerves, which supplies a nerve sensation down to the face, causing intense pain in his face and in his neck anytime those thorns moved. So this is what the soldiers did. They knelt down, they spat on him. They took a reed, they hit his head, they mocked him, and they put the reed back in his hand. So how many of the hundreds did this? I don't know. But one after another, they walk up to him, they kneel before him, they mock him, whatever they want to say. They hit his head with the reed, causing those thorns to dig into his scalp and create even more sensations of pain, and then they give the reed back. One after the other, one after the other. Exhausted, ripped apart, publicly humiliated, in major pain, being mocked, yet in enduring. Still no sin. Then they take him to crucify him, where the people and the priests and the soldiers blasphemed him and ridiculed him and taunted him. We're going to read Mark chapter 15 and verse 25 will begin. And it was the third hour and they crucified him. And the superscription of his accusation was written over the King of the Jews. And with him they crucified two thieves, and one on his right hand and the other on his left. And the scripture was fulfilled, which saith, "And he was numbered with the transgressors." And they that passed by railed on him, wagging their heads, saying, "Ah, thou that destroyest the temple and buildest in 3 days, save yourself, save thyself, and come down from the cross." Verses 31 and 32. Likewise also the chief priests mocking said among themselves with the scribes, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let Christ, the King of Israel, descend now from the cross, that we may see and believe." And they that were crucified with him reviled him. So think of the mental aspect, again, of the mocking and the mocking of those that you are there to save. How would you have responded at that point? All the way up to this point, what kind of mental control would you have? Well, we know what Christ had. Turn to Luke chapter 23 and verse 34. Luke 23 and 34. Then said Jesus, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And they parted his raiment and cast lots. After all of this, after all that he endured, ripped apart physically, tormented, humiliated, mocked emotionally, abandoned, he still had love. He said, "Father, forgive them." What a mental attitude. So what did Christ do? Well, he rejected the self and he loved all of us. And he did that for us. So what is he asking us to do? Reject the self and love the brethren. The same thing, because he is our example. Is that too much for us to do? Do we find our mission too difficult? Is not having what we want in life so bad that it's worse than what Christ did for us? So what is our vision and what are we really here for? And why talk about this on Unleavened Bread? Well, this week, we should focus on two parts of our job, rejecting the self and loving the brethren. And we know this and we want to do this. And we know we have to sacrifice and we know the work is hard to accomplish this. But I hope hearing the enormity of Christ did for us will bring some perspective that will make us work harder. Christ did that. He suffered and he endured for us. He willingly did that for us. So what are we willing to do for him?
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented Christ Suffered for Us, a message given by Mr. Robert Burke for the morning service of the first high day of the Days of Unleavened Bread, April 23rd, 2024.